Zooropa, that's the name of the song, that's the name of the album, and good evening, The Edge. How are you this evening?
I'm feeling very good, David.
Good. How did you like Cork?
I enjoyed it. I thought it was one of the better shows that we've done recently, and it's nice to be playing in front of an Irish audience.
It's nice to be playing in front of an Irish audience again, is it?
It is.
A sort of homecoming.
A sort of a homecoming, yeah.
So tomorrow and Saturday. Is it like, the fact that you're doing two gigs in Dublin, does that mean that there might be a difference between the two, like when you do two in the one place?
We try and vary things as much as we can. But it's funny, after, what is it, almost 2 years now, although the show has changed a lot over that time, you, after a little while, you actually start to settle into a particular format, which is the best format for the show. And sometimes it's difficult to change that, knowing that you're actually altering what is ultimately the best possible show. So it's found this kind of format over the last little while, and we're throwing in some new songs from time to time. We did a couple down in Cork. I'm sure we'll do at least one or two in Dublin. But, you know, we'll see. We tend to decide pretty much on the day, a few hours before we do the show, what to play.
Right, because down in Cork you had Stay and Numb from the Zooropa album. So you think there might be more from the Zooropa album or from the Zooropa sessions? Because let's face it, we've only got, what is it, about 10 or 11 songs on the Zooropa album. So it was about 20 songs altogether that you did in those sessions.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call all 20 of them songs there. There was probably about 4 or 5 that were fairly well developed, but a lot of the others were just beginnings, just improvisations or sketches, which never made full band arrangements. We have a lot of stuff, yeah.
Well, you still don't have any singles on the album, because None was only a radio single. So does that mean there won't be any, or the talk of Lemon being a single?
We started out with the idea that we wouldn't release singles initially, and we'd see how we went. And so far, I think it's worked as an experiment, because we've had a lot of support from radio, which we weren't sure we would get, and at the same time, you know, it hasn't seemed to affect sales or anything. I mean, the main reason everyone says nowadays for singles is promotion. But I think that we're in a different situation to most bands, because we have such a loyal following that people, you know, hear a new U2 album is out, and they go and buy it because they're into the band. They don't need a single on Radio 1 to tell them that there's a new album out there.
Right, yeah. Okay, well, if you just go back a little bit, just go back to 18 months, say, when the Zoo TV thing started in America. Now, I saw the second gig in Florida, and that was indoors, right? Now, at that time, there was no talk of any album. There was no Zooropa album whatsoever. So how did the actual Zooropa album come about?
Well, we had the beginning of the year free, and we were just talking about what we were going to do before going back out on the road in Europe with the Zooropa tour. And we thought, well, we've a few songs that we'd like to try and put down. Let's just go into the studio and see what happens. So we got together, and, well, I went in first into kind of pre-production, setting up the studio and everything in early February. And we just started playing a bit and throwing down a few ideas, and initially we thought, well, maybe we'll release something at the end of these sessions. We might put together sort of 3 or 4 tracks, maybe 6 if we're really lucky. But after about 4 weeks of just putting things together, and when particularly when Flood arrived and we started getting on quite well with the work, we just thought, well, we could have an album here if we just push ourselves a bit further. And when Brian arrived, he felt very similarly. In fact, he was saying, well, you actually could do 2 albums if you really wanted to. I mean, you've got another 6 or 7 weeks to go. Let's just try and move through ideas fast. Let's try doing some more improvisation and see how we get on. And ideas just kept coming, and everyone was playing really well, and lyrics didn't seem to be as much of a problem as they have been in the past, and suddenly it seemed possible to put an album out. So we just pushed. The last 4 weeks were particularly intense. Up until then, things had been very relaxed, and we managed to get the 10 tracks ready in time.
Well, lyrics weren't as much of a problem as they had been in the past. If, say, after the Unforgettable Fire, say, coming towards the Joshua Tree and etc., that you sort of were writing songs formally, for want of a better word, does that mean that now Zeropa has allowed you to be experimental and can therefore sort of be a bit looser, and even Bono can be a bit looser with his job?
Well, I think we did go through a period of figuring out some of the formal songwriting techniques, you know, the chops of songwriting during the Joshua Tree and Rattle and Hum albums. And I suppose having learnt the craft of songwriting, we felt that on this record we could sort of leave that to one side and allow the music to become at times much less formal, much less structured, and that the theory was that as the pieces became finished and a certain amount of discipline placed on them, that they would quite naturally turn into songs, and that did happen in a few cases. It just meant that instead of looking at the album as a very structured collection of individual songs that had been written, we broadened the base a bit, and we allowed music that at one stage we were describing as soundtrack stuff and just pure improvisations to broaden the, I suppose, the base on which we founded the collection of pieces that made the album from. So it gave us, I suppose, an extra level of freedom, and it it allowed the band to start playing together in a very initially unstructured, undisciplined way, which means you get through a lot of ideas very fast. And some of the tracks that came together out of that method actually ended up taking very little time to come together. Other pieces that were written in a more formal way took a lot longer. Mm. So I suppose you're heading for the same thing, but you approach it from different directions, and you end up with a different sounding track as a result of starting from an improvisation or starting from a piece that wasn't really designed to be a song initially.
Well, then what about the actual release of the album Zeropa? I mean, like, by 1988, after the Joshua Tree, you were called everywhere, and even before that, the biggest rock band in the world. So therefore, when Rattle and Hum came out, it became a bit of a circus, to put it bluntly. I mean, you even said at one stage that when you saw them airbrushing your stubble out of the poster outside some cinema in Madrid, you knew there was something fishy going on here. And then Achtung Baby, like you said, at the end of 1990 at the Point Depot, you said, okay, we're going to give it all up to start it all over again and dream it all up again. So you did, and you went two years off, went to Berlin, got Achtung Baby together. This time around, is it a double-edged sword being as big as you two are, in that on one level you're expected to sort of let the record company sort of have 6 or 7 weeks, or maybe even 2 or 3 or 4 months, to get the whole thing together to release this album and get the whole sort of bam, as opposed to just sort of, hold on a second, we are that big, so we can do what we like, we're just going to slip this album out, and they say, hey lads, wait a minute, you can't bring an album out in 2 weeks, we're not ready for it. So was there a difficulty there?
I think people were a little apprehensive about what might happen, you know, within the record company, but they actually ended up getting really into the idea, and you know, they were very supportive, and they, to be fair to them, they didn't really know up until the last couple of weeks what they were going to receive, whether it was going to be an EP or an album, or, you know, whether we were just going to leave it, because at one stage towards the end we were so confident and so happy with what we were doing that we felt that we didn't want to put it out if it wasn't finished. So there was also the possibility that we would have held it back and done the tour and then got back to it at the end of the tour. So they really hadn't a clue what they were going to get. And I have to say, you know, this, people always have this impression of the corporate world of the music business as being this inflexible kind of entity where new ideas can't possibly emerge, but we found the opposite to be the case, that once they knew kind of what we were up to, they were very prepared to bend their own rules and you know, get involved in the experiment.
Well, is it fair to say that Zoo TV, which of course was on the road first, and in other words the stage show, actually spawned Zeropa the album, that Zeropa the album would never have been possible without having done this stage show first?
I think it did inspire us in many ways. I mean, the visuals, the new style of video art that we've employed for our show, you know, working with people like EBN or Mark Pellington in particular from the States, who are part of a new breed of video artist. They're almost video sample artists in the same way that sampling has affected the music business with, you know, hip-hop and the dance movement. It's also affected the video art movement. And we started to look at the audio-visual aspect of songs in a different way. We started to see that they don't necessarily have to be two different entities, that the two can start to blend into one another. So that was one springboard, and that affected, I suppose, structure of some songs, the lyric approach of some songs, and the themes of the songs as well. And I definitely think that this album was really inspired to a large extent by being on the road with the Zoo TV tour and playing around with the questions that tour threw up.
So is it then fair to say in some ways that the album is like, if it is the tour as such, that it's the first time that we've had something like this? I mean, normally the album of a tour is a live double album or something which comes out afterwards.
Yeah.
Now in this case, it's really the album of the tour without, even though I know you now do Stay and Numb, without really including any of the songs from the album, if you know what I mean.
It is kind of strange, but that is the case. It's like the difference between the tour and the album is getting more and more blurred, especially now since obviously we're making videos for the album, for the tracks on the album, but also some of those videos have come out of the stage show,
yeah.
You know, so it's all getting much less defined, and this kind of blurring of lines, I think, is very inspiring. It's kind of, you feel like there are no rules, you know, that define where one thing starts and where the other ends, and there's a certain amount of cross-pollinization of ideas which keeps you, you know, keeps it all very interesting for you.
The backlash in some ways has started, especially with the gigs in Britain. The first one you played in Glasgow, there was a few reviews and said, whoops, I'm not too sure about this at all, and the Sarajevo bit, etc.
Mm-hmm.
With Bono being, a lot of people thought, just a bit ridiculous, because he's doing this thing, first of all, saying that we're all ashamed, and then he goes back into a rock and roll gig. I'm not exactly sure what the critics wanted you to do, stay with Sarajevo for 3 years, I'm not sure. But like, even the Nazi imagery that you use, which is there specifically at the beginning, or more specifically at the beginning than any other time, do you find that that's a bit of a time bomb, and maybe that, like, do you know what you're doing there?
Well, we started out with the intention of trying to underscore the main question of the tour, I suppose, the Zooropa tour, which is the question is, what do you want? You know, and it's a question, I suppose, that everyone is struggling to find an answer for in the music business. You know, i.e., where are we going? What is the future going to be? And we also are asking it as Europeans at the moment. Europe is in complete turmoil. No one really knows not only who they are but who they want to be as Europeans, and what they have to give up and what they hope to gain by being in Europe. And it seemed like it seemed like a fairly defensible way of getting that point across by using imagery that in the past has been propaganda for other political solutions for these questions, ideological solutions, albeit obviously failed and horrendously evil systems. It seemed like to us that in showing people the imagery that was used to sell these ideas of National Socialism, or in the case of some of the communist icons, you know, the idea of communism, to really underscore that, you know, this is maybe where we've come from and where are we going. And I think that it's obviously when you borrow imagery like that, which is so potent and so powerful, it's possible for people to misinterpret it. But I think that the vast majority of our audience and the vast majority of people who have any kind of brain would get the idea of what we're trying to do. There's always going to be a minority of people who either choose not to understand or are just, you know, not smart enough to understand what we're trying to say. But I think it would take an incredible jump to imagine that because we've used Leni Riefenstahl footage that you two have suddenly become fascists, which I suppose is the argument for not doing what we did.
Okay, well then what about the Sarajevo link-up, which we didn't have in Cork? Is that now part of the past? Have you made your point?
I think we felt we had, yeah. I think maybe, in retrospect, we probably should have ended at a few more shows earlier, because I think the point had been made when we first introduced that idea into the show. It was in Italy, in Verona, and we were about, at that stage, about 300 miles as the crow flies from Sarajevo. And also, at that point in time, Sarajevo was not really on page one of any of the international newspapers. It was like page seven, and, you know, you really had to go looking for it. And we were approached by Bill Carter from Sarajevo TV. He came to our show in Italy, and he really came without having a proposal as such, but just to see what we were doing and to let us know what was happening in the city that he was working in. And we'd, I suppose, like anyone, tried as best we could to keep abreast of the situation there, but were as confused as everybody else was about what was going on. It seems that there is this kind of veil of impenetrable veil of kind of confusing reports that hangs over Sarajevo as a news story, whereby no one really seems to, you know quite what's happening and who's to blame and what should be done. But the way he described things, he said, look, it's actually quite a simple situation. It's just no one really seems to want to bite the bullet and do anything about it. So we talked about going over to Sarajevo and doing a concert, and we investigated. In fact, we started to make plans to do that. There is, in the city, in an underground shelter, a nightclub or concert venue which is run three nights a week and holds about 500 people. And it's kind of the one contact that the citizens of Sarajevo have to a rock and roll kind of show or a good time or music or whatever, a way for them to kind of get away from the horror of their day-to-day existence. And Bill was explaining that in this place you'll have guys and women who are, you know, having a great time, you know, knocking back the drinks, dancing to whatever's on the turntable, and yet, you know, some of them would have lost parents, friends that day. Some of them, now that they'd be back on the front line the next day trying to hold out against the Chetnik army. Anyway, we ended up not being able to go because Bill explained that the real problem in Sarajevo is as you get a group of people together, there are spies all over the city who radio or telephone the artillery batteries outside the city, and suddenly, you know, any group of more than like five or six people would become a target for the mortars. So he said, look, I think it's going to be too dangerous for you to come, not for you, but for the people who would gather to come and see you play. So we knocked that idea on the head. And then we thought, well, look, Zoo TV is really about making connections. It's about taking in broadcast material, be it produced by other networks and sent over the satellites to Europe, or in this case, a connection that we were going to make ourselves. And really the thinking was very simple, is that we wanted to just give the people of Sarajevo a window through which that they could address our audience and tell them exactly what was going on, not in any kind of editorialized CNN soundbite style, but actually abrupt, rude, barefaced, just the facts, what these people were going through. And we knew that it was a risk in the sense that putting something that potent and that shocking in the middle of a rock and roll show, which is ultimately about, you know, having a good time and seeing your favorite band play a few songs, could completely scuttle the show. And on some nights it almost did, and Glasgow was one of those nights, which is why we got killed by the reviewers. But I think the point that we were trying to make, other than just trying to give Sarajevo a kind of mouthpiece, if it was only to our audience, was that in this day and age, news reports have become entertainment, you know? The way that news is produced, TV news, it's all about ratings, it's all about presenting stories in an interesting, amusing way. And it really, it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with presenting the facts as they are. What was so shocking about the Sarajevo connection in our show was that it was anything but entertaining. It was the very opposite of that. And that's why it was so hard for us to kind of continue the show. And some nights, I have to be honest, when Sarajevo Link came to an end, it was the very last thing we wanted to do, was to carry on playing the concert. But I suppose that's what we all do anyway, isn't it? When you've seen some horrific thing on the TV.
Oh, yeah.
You have to keep going. And, you know, when you're dealing with something as difficult as that, you just know that the odd time it's going to go off in your face and it's actually going to really throw the show into a tailspin. And a couple of times it did. But what we hoped, I suppose, also to achieve from it was maybe to generate a little bit more media coverage of what was going on there. And, of course, now events have overtaken us and Sarajevo is now right on the front page again. So we sort of feel in some ways that it's no longer as important as it was, and that maybe, you know, we felt that it was probably time to move on to something else.
So in some ways then, does it go back to what you said a few years ago when you saw the Gulf War on TV, the way we all did, that like Americans were coming back having flown the planes, having blown up loads of people, saying, hey, it was just like real life, as though they were out there with video games up in these airplanes?
Yeah, well, there is this tendency for TV coverage of events to distance you from it, so you feel like you're seeing it, but it's been so pasteurized by editing and by, you know, a journalist's narration and the editorialization of news production, that you're really seeing a very benign version of the reality that's out there. And I don't know, that when I watch the news now, I find I'm less and less affected by what I see. You know, there's the odd image that connects, but most of it is just like it's water off a duck's back. And I think that it doesn't inspire you to do something, to act on the information that you're given. It inspires a kind of curiosity and then very little else. Mm. And I'm not sure what we can do about this, because TV is becoming more and more about ratings and about, well, you know, we have to get a character as our anchor person because, you know, the other channel have a pretty girl. So we have to... We have to appeal, you know, and when the news is starting to try to appeal to people, you know, I think it becomes a different thing than just the dissemination of information.
Mm. Okay, well then, spot the irony in this one here. I'm about to play an ad break. Hold on, Edge. Fanning on 2FM till 10 o'clock. It's 21 minutes to 9. We're talking live here with the Edge from rock band U2. Edge, that song there that's playing in the background, Babyface, is possibly one of the core songs on the album in terms of what TV and what people accept from images. I mean, it is sort of like, instead of having a girlfriend or whatever, this guy who's watching the TV has a girl on the TV, say, whatever. In other words, passion is passé, and you can sort of relate on a level that's just ludicrous. Is that sort of one part of what Zoo TV might be and Zooropa might be?
Yeah, well, we go on to TV, the drug of a nation, from the disposable heroes of hypocrisy. I suppose that is one of the things that we're pointing out is TV and what it means in the 90s, and it is remarkable how important it is today, you know, the box, and it's, you know, you see it everywhere. I've seen it now in the way fans approach us. You know, they don't rush forward with autograph books anymore. They stand there with handy cams. You know, it's almost like to experience anything, it has to be captured and then relived on the TV, you know, so it is its own kind of a new reality, and it also, for a lot of people, it seems to legitimize experience and even themselves in a weird way. People, I think, certainly in America now, see getting on the television as some sort of way of establishing their existence to the world, and I suppose that it's you know, in that lyric in Babyface, we're touching on that. Also, I suppose the sexuality and all that. I mean, it's said that initially that the handicam became a popular item because it was a way of people making their own pornography at home. I mean, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's...
You haven't tried it yourself,
I haven't tried it myself. Talk to Rob Lowe, I suppose. He would.
Yeah, Rob Lowe knows all about that one. All right. So, in other words, therefore, like, sometimes if fans come, when they do, when you two are very much in the news, and look over the walls of the four members of the houses to get a glimpse, they're not looking over, they're putting the camcorder over so they can watch it back home.
That's exactly it, yeah. It's a strange one. So you're not actually meeting people, you're just... You're actually saying hello to what will ultimately be, you know, them through the TV set.
Okay, well now what about these two sort of alter egos of Bono saying, obviously it would be better to put this to Bono, but if you'd have The Fly on one level and Mephisto on the other level, which people will see both in the concert, obviously. If in one way you two might have been seen as political advocates or moral crusaders or benefit headliners or whatever, is there any way at all that you thought there might have been a bit of an image thing that, look, we're going to have to do something about this, let's rock and roll or whatever, or let's make a sort of a, like, if this thing allows you sort of to portray and then ridicule what you are, if you like, and like the Bono can do that with these two alter egos or whatever, and it's a totally new area that you can move into, and it's, if it's accepted, it's as though if there was ever an image problem with you two, they've now got this totally new image, so deal with that, public.
I don't think it started out anything like that. It started out really as a way of presenting some of the new songs on Acton Baby, particularly The Fly, which was written from a very ironic point of view, and as a sort of lyric study, was based on a character that Bono had invented, the Fly character, who was this kind of character that we've all met. He's the guy who sits at the end of the bar and seems to know everything about what's going on, and you just know that he's very unhinged, but he seems to be, you know, seems to know the president personally and whatever. And when we came to doing the video, Bono thought, well, why don't I actually become the Fly for the video and see how that, what that's like. So he kind of played around with that, and we all thought that it was a very interesting foil for him as a performer to do that. So when it came to putting the show together, it seemed like a kind of natural next step to use that character in the show. And I suppose Mephisto is really developed from another character that may have started really in the song Desire, which was part of the Rattle and Hum album, and kind of was inspired by America at that time. You know, he's a combination of televangelist, come secondhand car salesman, you know, gleaned from little moments of American TV, which can be very out there. And in America, the Mephisto character was the Mirrorball Man, who was this kind of crazy character in a Mirrorball Stetson and, you know, Mirrorball suit. But when we went to think about the European tour, we thought, well, this Mirrorball Man character won't really have any resonance in Europe, so why don't we just bring it down to its actual essence? So we thought, well, who is this character? So we reckon, well, he's the devil, I suppose. That's who he is. So we just brought it down to Mephisto. And he's all sorts of different references rolled into one, you know. A lot of them are theatrical references. But it's, I suppose it's the Goethe's Faust, the Mephistopheles character, from the classic tale. And, it just gives Bono a new way in to some of these songs and a way of altering his approach to the performance of them. And it's taken songs like With or Without You or Love is Blindness or, Light My Way into a completely different place, which is great fun for us as much as anything else, and gives him a great opportunity to as a performer to alter and shed new light on the lyrics.
Do you think in any way, if we take like the 90s U2, the way so many of the bands that were supposedly around when you were coming up, anything from say Simple Minds to Big Country, I don't know, who are now sort of consigned to I don't know what heap, but not exactly the front lines, let's say, do you think in any way that you changed as music changed? I mean, in Britain it was, say, you know, Stone Roses and Happy Mondays. In America it was the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Nirvana. And that you changed and came with something new around the same time, and that the whole thing sort of helps. There was no method in that at the time.
No, well, I mean, I don't think we were thinking in terms of how are we going to fit in amongst all these other groups. But I suppose we had been through that, you know, in a sense. You know, the Rattle and Hum record and that tour was our exploration of, you know, the origins of rock and roll. And we'd been through that, so we wanted to move forward, you know, to actually try and move into the future. And it seemed to us that most of the groups that were coming through were very much drawing from the past. And obviously a lot of the people that were buying their albums were too young to remember, you know, the origins of the sounds that they were using. But we just thought that it was time to look to the future. And I suppose also we were interested in trying to develop a set of sounds that we could believe in again, because I suppose we were all starting to feel like the classic U2 sound had become so well known and so easily kind of connectable to us and to the work that we'd done in the past, that we felt that it was necessary to kind of try and devise a fresh set of sounds, new ways of, you know, playing and you know, the drums, or new ways of treating guitar sounds, even vocal sounds, because I suppose to a certain extent we lost some faith in the classic sounds of a rock and roll band. You know, you hear them used so much in, you know, music that I don't think is particularly imaginative, that it's hard now, for me anyway, to listen to wound up, you know, guitar through a Marshall amp without having all these connotations come to mind of bad American rock. So we really wanted to break away from the stigma, I suppose, of those sounds and that music, and give ourselves some space by sounding very different.
Well, to get back to the Zeropa album, what about like some of the characters that are there? I mean, we played Babyface, pretty sad character in some ways. Stay, pretty sad song lyrically, most definitely. What about, like, for instance, The First Time, which is like a prodigal son thing, who doesn't want to be the same as the prodigal son, or treated the same way, say, as in the Bible or whatever. And that you have these characters running through, and then you have the last song, which is The Wanderer, and Bono doesn't sing that song. Instead, Johnny Cash sings it. Now, The Wanderer is probably the only character on the whole album that actually sort of wants to be saved, if you like, regardless of how lost he is, as much as all the other characters. So do you think in some ways that if Bono had sung it, people might have sort of missed that, and you needed the distance in order to sort of bring the album to a bit of a balance, and therefore put somebody like Johnny Cash in on vocals?
Well, that track was actually originally started on the Acton Baby Sessions, although it was a very different piece. It was a full band arrangement, and it had a completely different feel. You wouldn't recognise it now. And the first step in getting towards The Wanderer was actually an idea I had to rearrange it with electronic instruments and start from a completely mechanical, machine-like point of view. And so I did some work on that, and Bono came in and he started trying to sing on it, and he started coming up with this other melody, and he started to think that maybe it wasn't for his voice, that maybe we needed another voice, and that the voice that he was imagining was Johnny Cash. So really, it started out more as a musical decision as much as anything. And then, with that in mind, he started working on the words, started rewriting with Johnny in mind. And it was kind of as he was working on the words that the idea for the character started to emerge. And he definitely wrote it with Johnny Cash in mind. So I think that was the point where that decision was made. Later on, Brian Eno was trying to persuade Bono to sing it himself. I think he'd written it really with Johnny in mind, and I just don't think he ever felt that it would suit his range and his particular approach. I think if he was going to sing it himself, he would have written a slightly different song.
And so it was fortuitous that Johnny just happened to be in Dublin at the time. Like, would you have taken that song to, say, Nashville or wherever he might have been?
Well, that was a piece of pure luck, actually. He happened to be here, and we made contact with him at his show in Dublin, and put it to him, you know, that we had this piece, and would he be interested in singing on our record. At that stage, it was very speculative. We didn't really know if he was going to be able to do it or not, or whether he'd be into it. But he did, and he came down and he really sort of got into it. I think he was a bit confused at first about the arrangement. You know, he kept asking me, what's this going to sound like when you guys are on it? You know, he was expecting it to sound more like us. But I think we all knew pretty much the minute he opened his mouth that it was going to work, you know, that this juxtaposition of Johnny Cash singing over this bizarre kind of almost suicide-like backing track was going to be an interesting combination.
The Wanderer is the name of the song. It's the one that closes the album Europa, and we're talking here to the Edge. Now, Edge, tell us, like, I mean, you've been on this tour for a long time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just got bigger and bigger as it's gone along. I mean, like, rather than just say, how's the head?
How is the head?
Yeah.
I have to say, it's a bit strange being back in Dublin with Europa, because Dublin, throughout the whole tour, has always been the kind of refuge where we've run to for a few days break in the middle of the madness, and now it's like the madness has come home, has followed us home. So it's a slightly surreal, you know, as if things weren't already surreal enough, to actually be back in Dublin with it all is very strange. But it's good. I mean, the end is in sight for the Europa tour, and it's a good feeling, I must say. I don't think people are as tired as they would be had it not gone so well, and had we not enjoyed it so much.
So, it's the end for Europa in terms of Europe, but you're going to take it maybe where? To Australia and Japan or something like that?
Yeah, we have, I think, about 10 shows at the end of the year in Australia, New Zealand and Japan, which will be the very end.
Zoomeranga.
Zoomerang, yeah. Or Zumo, we're thinking for Japan.
Or Kangaroo. Something like that. So you are going to bring it there, and then what happens after that? I mean, like, let's face it, like, Europa is, or Zoo TV is this big yoke right now. I mean, could it get bigger? And does bigger mean wider, or what does it mean? I mean, like, can you just go higher? Will you have to get more aircraft lights for the top of the stage?
I don't know. I mean, this idea is about as big as it can be, you know, the Zoo TV thing. I don't know. We haven't really made any plans, and we're enjoying the fact that we don't have any plans. Next year is going to be, certainly for the first three quarters of the year, will be time to disappear off and just get into whatever, you know, whatever's going to enrich the songwriting for the next record, you know, maybe some travelling, maybe just staying in Dublin and listening to the Dave Fanning show, whatever.
Indeed, what a good idea.
So we're not really concerned about it. There's a lot of work, you know, coming in at the moment, which we're trying to avoid getting involved with. And we'll just see. The end of next year, we'll just start all over again, I suppose. And where that will end, I don't know.